from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. By now, you've probably seen the ugly spectacle of the Friday night NBA player-fan brawl tumbling across your TV screen. Fights are nothing new in professional athletics, but by all accounts, we turned some kind of corner in the Detroit-Indiana game, stepping into the dark side of spectator sport. The league was quick to crack down with the steepest penalties in its history. 9 players have been suspended, 1 for the rest of the season, and police are looking into criminal charges. But there's more going on here than broken rules, and it's not just the NBA. Something strange is boiling, and the explosive violence of the Friday night fight shot out at America like steam from the pot. Tonight on Point, the NBA's weekend melee and the ugly escalation of violence in sport. You can join the conversation. What happened on Friday night at the Pistons-Pacers game? What was really going on there? Who do you blame for the meltdown? The players, the fans, the league, sports radio, PlayStation 2? And what's the cultural context that lets a game become a riot? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Southington, Connecticut, is ESPN.com's NBA insider, Chad Ford. Chad, what's the latest on Friday night's brawl? Where are we going with penalties next?
I'm not sure that there will be any more penalties. I think the league is now looking at what happened in Detroit and wondering if there was some sort of breakdown with the Pistons franchise. Was the security not appropriate? Did they not handle the incident the right way? But the early accounts that I've heard is that the Pistons followed all their protocols, and now the league is looking at those protocols and deciding whether they need to make fundamental changes in how the fans are protected from the players, and the players, in turn, are protected from the fans.
Chad, for anybody who wasn't watching the game and didn't see it played over the weekend when it was played again and again, just give us a description of what happened.
Well, it started with about 45 seconds left in the basketball game when Ron Artest, the player who has a history of on and off the court violence, and also, by the way, was the NBA Defensive Player of the Year last year, fouled Ben Wallace, another very physical basketball player and a former Defensive Player of the Year.
And this is Artest with Indiana, Wallace with Detroit, and of course
the Detroit Pistons.
Artest suspended 6 times last season, so no stranger to controversy. He's the Pacers' bad boy.
Yeah, 6 times over the course of his career.
Sorry, yes.
6 times last season. Mm-hmm. He the foul was considered harsh. The game was out of reach, and Wallace objected to the foul by pushing Artest in the chest and in the neck. Artest, who has a history of a quick temper, did not retaliate. In fact, he moved to the scorer's table while the two teams shoved and pointed fingers and screamed at each other.
And didn't just move to the table. He went over and lay down on the scorer's table or the TV broadcast table there, kind of just stretched out on it.
He did, and he did it intentionally. Because he had been fined and suspended by the league before, he wanted to make it very clear to whoever was watching,
right,
that he was not involved in the fight. He was not trying to retaliate. He was not trying to escalate the argument.
But then
it was at that point that a fan threw a bottle of water and hit Artest in the face as he laid on the ground. And at that point, he lost it and jumped into the stands. Attacking a person that we found out later was not the person who threw the bottle.
And we're not talking just one row into the stands. He really climbed up into the stands and went after this guy.
Right. He thought, and he said later, that he thought he saw the person who threw it. He did not, as some people have reported, punch the fan. He grabbed the fan. He definitely kind of pushed him to the ground. And then, according to the fan, he asked him, "Did you do it? Did you do it?" To which the fan replied, "No, I did not." And after another second or two, Artest let go of the fan. Unfortunately, at that point, there was a riot going on in Detroit. The fans were hitting Artest. Several of the other Pacer players had moved into the stands. One of them, Steven Jackson, was swinging wildly at other fans in the stands. The players were being hit. The players were swinging back and hitting fans. And eventually that violence escalated back onto the court. As the players moved back onto the court, several fans reached the court, and one of them was punched in the face by Artest as he moved towards Artest.
And at that point, anyone who's seen the images, the whole place just looks like it's boiling. People sprawling and punching and just every kind of mayhem going on.
It was absolute mayhem at that point. You have to understand that the security detail at an NBA game, while there are armed police officers there, there was 10 in the entire arena that night. If you think about the almost 20,000 people in the arena, 10 is going to have a difficult job controlling the crowds. There's also a number of security personnel who are private security personnel in the arena. I've been to Detroit several times to watch basketball games there. They tend to be typically older gentlemen who serve as much as ushers as they do security. And so
this is not real security. It's not like when we saw the essentially riot police at the Red Sox-Yankees game when things got tense there. This is very, very spare security.
Very spare security, frankly, because the NBA has never had an incident like this before. And there's a lot of second guessing now. Should the referees have put an end to the match earlier? Eventually, the game was called before the game was over. Should they have put an end to it earlier? Should they have gotten on the PA announcement and asked the fans to calm down? Should the security have gotten more involved? All we know is that the Pacers players, when they decided to leave the court and head back to the locker room, had a barrage of things thrown at them, drinks, beer poured on top of their heads, and one fan even threw a chair.
Just a cascade of stuff raining down on them as they left the arena. And is there any question that this is the most dramatic event like this that the NBA has ever seen, Chad?
Absolutely, from everything that I've seen. Now, I also travel the world covering not only basketball here in America, but international basketball, and this is quite common behavior for fans and for players in international basketball. I've seen entire teams go into the stands and take swings at fans and vice versa. I was in Greece once when a mob of angry fans overturned the team bus as the home team left the court. The home fans were so angry that the team had lost that they overturned the team bus.
So, Chad, are we being Pollyanna-ish here in our response to this, or is the United States losing something when that comes to our shores?
I think we're losing something. I think it has a lot to do with about our discourse and how we discourse in the United States at this moment. I think you can look at it from a political standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, and also it certainly bleeds into sports as well. This generation of not civil discourse, but screaming at each other. If you go to sports talk radio or if you look at how fans interact with each other now, there's not a lot of intelligent debate out there. There's a lot of screaming.
And finally, Chad, NBA Commissioner David Stern saying he's disgusted, saying there may be changes here. Basketball players are sometimes called cagers because we're reading now in the early days of basketball that sometimes have a kind of rope cage around the court to keep this kind of thing from happening. Are we going to be heading back to something like that? Are they going to have to put up hockey-style barriers around basketball courts?
I don't think we're going to get there. I think one of the great things about the NBA is its intimacy. It's the ability of fans to get as close to the action as you can get in any professional sport. And I think that the league would lose a tremendous amount if they did that. Now, even in some of these European countries where fan violence is out of control, they have not resorted to that, though they have done things such as install plexiglass backs over the benches so fans cannot throw things at players, and also coverings into the walkways as players try to leave the court, things that the NBA could possibly implement. I think that going to the cage may be a little extreme at this point.
At this point, but what a scene that was. Talk about extreme. Chad Ford, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Take care.
We're talking about the basket brawl the world saw Friday night, the NBA's weekend melee, and the ugly escalation of violence in sport. I'm joined tonight in the studio by Jeff O'Brien. He's director of the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program at Northeastern University's Center for the Study of Sport in Society. Jeff O'Brien, thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
And with us tonight from Fort Collins, Colorado, Jay Coakley. He's professor of sociology at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs campus, and author of Sport in Society. Jay Coakley, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
It's good to be here.
Jeff O'Brien, first to you. First, I'm amazed that there even is such a thing as the violence prevention program in a sports curriculum like yours, but I guess we shouldn't be amazed. When you saw what many people saw on Friday night or over the weekend, it was as it was played again and again and again. We know this was a bad moment for the game, a bad moment for the teams. But what did it mean? What does it mean for American sport?
Well, we certainly look at sport as a reflection of society. And I thought we saw a very strong manifestation of the way gender is socially constructed. And what I mean by that is masculinity. And taking a deeper dive into that and really thinking about what was it that pushed somebody like Ron Artest to jump into those stands and go after the fans up in those stands.
Well, the plain fact was, we just heard, was a bottle of water in the face. Are you saying something more, something else?
Well, if you think about this decision-making around masculinity, Ben Wallace, who's a pretty large opposing player, shoves Artest pretty hard. Artest wants nothing to do with it, walks away, and sits and goes into this display.
But there's a wounded ego there behind that display of passivity at the moment.
That certainly could be a piece of it. And then you think about, my sense of what it means to be a man, at least what I've learned in this culture, then you have somebody laying on the table and somebody throws something at him, so his immediate reaction is to go up there and be physical and assault him. And being a man, there's no place for letting that go by.
But Jay Coakley, American men have functioned by whatever standards they functioned for a long time, and they haven't always, in the history of U.S. professional sport, gone up into the stands. What do you think made this different Friday night?
Well, I think that basically one of the main challenges in any sport event is to control and manage the relationship between fans and players. And what I think happened was that the norms that generally are followed by fans and by players were just ignored at that particular point, related to some of the issues that have already been raised, and also related to the specific dynamics of the situation. The fan throwing a projectile down and hitting a player, that's certainly going beyond the norms. And then Artest's response, his failure to control his emotional response at that point, and going up into the stands was also a violation of what is almost a taboo in American sport, and that is, you stay on the field of action. You don't confront fans in the stands.
So the norm is that whether there's a physical barrier there or not, there's this invisible line between fans and players. But Jeff O'Brien, increasingly in recent years, we see that crossed. More stuff being thrown out onto the courts, the fields of play, and the verbal abuse, just not just individual anymore, but elevated to the whole bleachers full of people swearing in unison at the players on the field.
To be sure, the lines have certainly become blurry over the years, and you even see cases that have escalated in number of youth sport activity, where you have parents and other, mostly parents, screaming and berating officials at a game involving 8-year-olds. And you certainly see how this could step itself up when they're paying what they consider a lot of money to come to a game. It's certainly a sad day, I think, for sport in this country. But the entitlement issues, I think, are something to certainly explore a little bit. What do these fans think they're entitled to when they pay for that ticket to come to a sporting event?
And there's a lot of speculation, Jay Coakley, since this happened, that fans feel entitled to a kind of relationship with the players, and the charge, in a way, that's been encouraged by the NBA, by professional sports itself.
Well, I think that's just a factor that's part of the whole commercial spectator sport phenomenon. Promoters, sponsors, owners, they certainly want to foster an emotional connection between the fans and the players. And that connection takes the form of identification with the players and the teams when it comes to the home team and the home players. But in some cases, it takes the form of animosity when it comes to the opposition. So in a sense, money is made off of fostering these kinds of emotional connections. I think the fact that prices are so high for tickets and for season tickets may lead some of these fans to feel a little bit entitled. But if you look at the way the events are structured,
they're structured around trying to get spectators emotionally involved.
And they sure do that. Jay Coakley, we've got to take a short break. Jeff O'Brien, please stand by. We're talking this hour about the basket brawl, the NBA's weekend melee, and the ugly escalation of violence in sport. You can join the conversation. What happened at the Pacers-Pistons game on Friday night? What was really going on there? Why are players ready to punch out fans at courtside? Why does everybody want to be a gladiator now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Friday night's basket brawl, the NBA's weekend melee, and the ugly escalation of violence in sport. You can join the conversation tonight. Why are players ready to punch out fans at courtside today? Why are fans lashing out now physically at players? Why does everybody seem to want to be a gladiator now? And why is everybody so angry and ready to put their fists behind their anger? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from Fort Collins, Colorado, by Jay Coakley, professor of sociology at the University of Colorado. With me in the studio tonight, Jeff O'Brien, director of the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program at Northeastern University's Center for the Study of Sport in Society. And right now, from San Francisco, by Phil Taylor. He's a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. Phil Taylor, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What are you taking away from this enormous incident on Friday night that's spilling right outside the boundaries of sports into the national conversation now, Phil? What's it mean?
Well, I think it's just kind of the logical extension of what's been going on in sports for, I would say, at least the last decade, if not longer. You know, having covered the NBA for about 8 years, I know that there's been a growing animosity that I've felt between players and the fans. I think both groups are becoming less and less able to relate to the other. I think part of that, a large part of that, has to do with the money that players are making. I think there's resentment from fans towards players because they are envious in a lot of ways of the huge salaries, and players in turn feel as though fans think that because the players make so much money that they should be willing to accept any sort of treatment, any sort of abuse, verbal or otherwise, from fans. I know that the players have said to me in the past that they feel almost as though fans look at them as animals in a zoo, that they are there for their entertainment and they can be poked and prodded in any way, and they should absorb it. So I think that sort of hostility between the fans and the players finally reached a boiling point on Friday night in the Pistons and Pacers game.
But when this was at full tilt, Phil, and you saw it, everybody did, I mean, someone could have been easily, seriously injured here. There was a lot of muscle power being thrown around just as violently as it could be.
That's very true. I know that you know, colleagues of mine, other sports writers and people in the sports journalism business, we've said for a long time that I hope we're wrong, but it may only be a matter of time before someone is seriously hurt or even killed in a brawl. And when we say these things, usually we're talking about fisticuffs between athletes because players are getting so much bigger now, so much more athletic. They're moving at such high rates of speed. And in a lot of cases, they're much more belligerent than they once were. We've always thought that it's only a matter of time before someone lands a blow that really does some major damage. And certainly, once you throw the public into the mix, people who are not as big or not as able to absorb this sort of punishment, once that happens, that's the big fear, I think, among people inside the sports arena, that we're going to see a real tragedy, something even worse than what we saw on Friday night.
Jay Coakley in Colorado, Phil Taylor points to the enormous salaries that the athletes on the field of play make and the gulf that begins to build between them and the fans. As a sociologist, do you see that as you know, kind of building a us versus them mentality that we might have seen on display Friday?
Well, I think so. I think that the whole context of the game has changed, as Phil was pointing out, and I would make the case that given those changes, we have to revisit the norms that regulate how fans are involved in the game and relate to the players, and also revisit the norms that regulate how players deal with and respond to the fans. And and figure out what should be done. I think that we need to make those norms much more specific and concrete, and they have to be presented in a much more direct way to the fans.
But what does that mean? You mean handing out a sort of a instruction manual when people come to the stadium saying you can do X, Y, and Z, but not A, B, and C, or you'll be arrested, tossed out, just being explicit in that way?
So I think that it might be a good idea to provide some concrete sets of rules for some of the fans, and it may be good for some representatives of the team, for example, to make announcements before games where they anticipate that the emotions are going to be running high, where there's strong rivalries, where there's feelings of hostility between the fans and the opponents, and have a coach, a player, a former player, a local celebrity come out and actually talk about some of the limits here and encourage players or encourage fans to stay within those limits.
Jeff O'Brien, is that going to work? Can you talk America's sports fan population or the violent edge of it back from that edge? Is it enough to plead, to ask, to beg?
I think it's a difficult proposition just because we generally ask just the opposite of them. You know,
fire it up!
Home teams are, you know, the players are always known for trying to pump the crowd up.
Mm-hmm.
And pump the crowd up means being as unruly and loud and nasty as you can be. Now, certainly it doesn't go anywhere near asking them to incite the type of riot that we saw occur last weekend.
But it does goad people almost up right to the edge of that, doesn't it?
There's no question. And there's the whole mix of alcohol into some of these games as well, or the majority of these games, where you get people who have been drinking for the majority of the contest screaming and yelling, get highly emotive and involved in the game, and you never know what can happen.
Let's get a caller here. Alec is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Alec. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am a Celtic fan. And I won't go to a Celtic game anymore.
Why not?
Because I'm embarrassed to be a human being when I see the behavior around me.
But thousands of people are there. People are taking their kids. What's the problem, Alec?
Well, you know, as has been stated by your panelists, you know, the people are they're nasty and disrespectful and outrageous. But what I would like to talk about is the organizations really do a number of things to encourage this kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
They hand out these inflatable wands for fans to wave behind the opponents
when they're shooting their free throws, right?
So in order to disturb people when they're shooting free throws.
Mm-hmm.
When you listen to sportscasters, they are outraged whenever a call goes against their team. For example, when you I went to a Nets game, a Nets Celtics game,
yeah.
and there were fans who were yelling "wife beater" at Jason Kidd's wife. And you know, what I would like to see is after something like that happens, for one of the Celtic players to at the press conference condemn that.
And it doesn't happen.
You know, really speak out and say that they expect the visiting team to be treated appropriately. I mean, Jason Kidd, you know, whatever his personal life,
yeah,
he's a beautiful, beautiful player. And I don't believe that fans can't be excited and appreciate beautiful play by the opponent.
It's a beautiful thing to think. Of course, that's not what we saw on Friday, and you've not seen it on other nights or seen the other side of that, Alec. Thanks for your call. Phil Taylor, everybody has this sense that fans now go to the game, some significant portion, ready to participate in the most outrageous way, that's part of the attraction, the kind of acting out, shouting out, going, crossing all the boundaries and celebrating that is part of the appeal of going to professional sports now.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think that the major professional sports leagues in this country have encouraged fans to feel that way. As has been mentioned earlier, when you go to an NBA arena or an NFL game, even in some cases, I think to a lesser degree, a Major League Baseball game, fans are whipped into a frenzy. They're encouraged to think of the opposing team not just as opponents but as real enemies. The NFL, for instance, markets violence. They put out videos, video compilations of the greatest hits, the most bone-jarring tackles. So I think that we as fans are encouraged to look for that sort of violence, to appreciate it, to glory in it, and I don't think it's a surprise that some fans, and we are still talking about a small percentage of fans who go to these games that are the offenders. It's not surprising that some small percentage of them want to take part in it. I think the line gets more and more blurred, and I think that that's something that the professional sports leagues really have to take blame for and really have to take a serious look at.
Is it inevitable, Phil Taylor, that we develop a kind of European-style violent rowdiness in the stands that's always at risk of going out onto the field of play? I mean, we saw at the Red Sox-Yankees game when the phalanx of riot police went out, you know, right alongside the diamond, as if they were expecting hundreds or thousands of people to pour out of the stands and tear those players apart. Do we have to accept this as kind of a next evolutionary stage in American professional sport?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there certainly are ways to limit this. One of them, obviously, is to reduce or even eliminate the sale of alcohol. I do think that at these games, I do think that the public, you know, for instance, the brawl we saw the other night probably would never have taken place had not some of those fans been intoxicated. So I think that's one step. Whether the pro sports leagues are willing to take that step and give up the revenues that they get from that, that's another question. I think that emphasizing the ugliness that took place on Friday night, kind of reminding people of how badly things got out of hand, could make people take a second thought before they engage in something like this. So I do think that it's not inevitable that we go further down this road, but I think the pro sports leagues, the public, and athletes are really going to have to take a hard look at their behavior and be willing to change some of it if we're going to reverse the direction we're going.
And things do mount one piece on the other. We saw the fight at the Clemson University of South Carolina game that followed the Friday night brawl, and now they're both teams turning down bowl bids. It is a show of contrition over that. Michael's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm a fan, and I just wanted to, I guess, interject and make some statements about the players.
Let's hear it.
Well, they make a lot of money. A lot of us would like to be in their shoes, and we live through them. We go to the games. And,
sure.
You know, it's a hobby for some folks. Some folks are really diehard fanatics. But these guys are forced to perform. Well, not forced, but they're pressured to perform. There are people who make money off them, bet on them. And then you have fans who may be betting on them, or maybe that's their release or their outlet for the night from a hard week's work, and they go to a game, and it's like, oh, my team is losing.
Right.
You know, so they do what they think is going to make them feel better, but it should be some boundaries between the players and the fans, because the moral boundaries, as we saw Friday, are not working anymore.
Well, how do you get it wound up that high and exciting, Michael, without it spilling across that boundary? I mean, we all know what professional basketball is like. The fans are essentially right there on the court, practically. How do you keep this from becoming routine?
Well, it's definitely on the individual, and I know alcohol does play a part, but the consumption of the alcohol is also on the individual. And, you know, if you're not actually on the team, you think doing your part is actually going down and attacking a player? Well, yeah, well, I guess it worked. They got our test out for the season.
Yeah.
As far as stopping it, I don't know. I don't think it's enough cops to put in every arena for 82 games.
Absolutely.
For 28 teams to
Absolutely.
Stop it.
It cannot be done. Michael, thanks for that call. Jeff O'Brien, I mean, there's a point. A, you can't put enough police around these arenas, probably, to stop this. Though if you made an example of some people, maybe you could. But Michael also spoke to something else there. I mean, the depth to which fans are engaged and feel themselves like players. He says, hey, you know what? Our test is out for the season. There's a competitive. He's speaking as though, in a way, he or the fans are players. They made something happen here. Something, I guess, that would be the biggest penalty in the history of professional basketball if it stands.
I don't really see them as being that calculated to think that they were going to get our test out for the year, as much as it's what Michael referred to earlier in his statement about this sense of voyeuristic objectification, almost, if you will, where I don't think the fans see the players as real people. You know, I see them; they see them as entertainers, as robots, as performers. You're fine on the court, but I don't want to know anything about you other than that. And I think we've all been at events, particularly outdoor events in cold weather, where snowballs are launched from the upper deck down into the field, where I don't think the sense is that, well, this may hit somebody in the face and really hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're just objects down there. They won't be hurt by this. Or, you know, I can launch this bottle of water from up here. This isn't going to hurt anybody. And, you know, I certainly don't want to assume that that's what everybody's thinking, but there's certainly this sense of objectification of the athletes themselves.
Jay Coakley, when athletes were not in such a stratosphere of salaries and income, when they were more imaginably closer to the fans, was there less of a gulf in kind of human, I don't know, compassion between the stands and the field?
Well, I don't want to throw any cold water on our discussion about this particular case, because I think it really needs to be discussed. But if you go back and look at the history of spectator sports, we certainly have less spectator violence today than we did nearly a century ago.
No kidding. Give us an example. What kind of thing was going on?
Well, if you went back and looked at some of the accounts of for example, Chicago Cubs games, there were cases where people would bring weapons into the stands. They'd shoot them off either in celebration or in protest to the performance of the opposition. And there was certainly a lot more throwing of projectiles onto the field, heating up nails with lighters and throwing them at the players on the field. And just if you look at college football, the number of times the goalposts went down in the past, that it hasn't stopped completely, but there's less of that today. And we've got to remember there's 2,500 NBA games every year. And we're talking about one game. That's not to say that this isn't a problem that needs to be addressed very directly, and maybe some serious kinds of changes have to be made. But I don't think we're talking about a trend here of an evolutionary kind of set of changes where we're getting worse and worse.
Phil Taylor, Jay looks back a century and says it was pretty bad then, popping off pistols in the stands. And yet you write what you see is a kind of a negative evolutionary trend here toward more anger inside and outside the arenas.
I believe it is. I think that, I'm not an expert on what happened, in the sports arenas of 100 years ago, but I would imagine that one of the differences is that back then there weren't the measures that are taken now. I mean, one of the things that we have now, we do have security. We do have, in some arenas there are metal detectors. So things that happened long ago can't happen because I think there are more restrictions on fans now. I think it was more kind of the wild, wild west in those days. Yet we still are having, a significant number, I would say, of these sorts of incidents. And I think that part of the problem is that the public in general, I think, is arriving at the arena these days angry. I think that our culture, not to generalize too much, but I think that we're just angrier in general these days. I think you see these things, you see flare-ups, on the highways and in the supermarkets. There are all sorts of disputes, and I think that it's not surprising that sorts of behavior
right into the arena, arriving angry. Phil Taylor, stand by. We're talking about the basket brawl. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Friday night's basket brawl in the NBA and the ugly escalation of violence in American sport. With me tonight, Phil Taylor from Sports Illustrated, Jeff O'Brien from Northeastern University, and Jay Coakley joins us from Colorado tonight from the University of Colorado. You can join us as well. Who do you blame for the meltdown? The players, the fans, the league, sports radio. Is NBA basketball still for the kids? And do the punishments for the Friday night riot fit the crime? And I guess, bottom line, what is going on in America's sports arenas? What's being acted out there? What's coming in from outside. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sue's calling from Boston. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Glad to be able to speak. I am a baseball fan more than a basketball fan.
Okay, good year for you in Boston.
Bleacher seats through a number of Red Sox games. And, you know, I was sort of astonished that it was so empty when I arrived because I thought, oh, the seats have all been bought, they've all been taken, and there was all this space. And it was really because people were getting tanked up on Lansdowne Street and didn't come in until the third or fourth inning.
Right outside the stadium and then barreling in, yeah.
Yeah, and that's my sense of the way people arrive. My husband's gone to various Patriots games, that more and more it's a sort of, it's a kind of a celebration of booze plus the sport. And that really changes the way people appreciate the game itself. I mean, I'm old enough to remember being at Red Sox games when to hear the word suck pronounced publicly would have just, you know, frazzled everybody.
And now you can hear it from the voices of tens of thousands of people.
Yes, in unison. And children, too. And I wouldn't take a kid to a game anymore. I wouldn't take a child to any sports event, because it's full of really grotesquely drunk people. And it seems to me that's the thing which fuels all of this, and the thing which, I mean, people have mentioned it, but I think it's so central. And it has
booze right in the middle of it. Sue, let us pick that up. Phil Taylor, is there any way, realistically, and I know David Stern has said that he's going to consider cutting back on booze at NBA games, but will they really do that? Isn't that factored into every team's budget? Isn't that a pretty big line item?
It certainly is, and there's no way that liquor will ever be completely eliminated from our stadiums and arenas. However, there are, I believe, in the NFL, they do cut off beer sales at the beginning of the fourth quarter, for instance. And I think those sorts of things are at least a step in the right direction, because if you do look at the incidence of violence between fans and players, of fans stepping over the line, it usually happens late in games, in the seventh or eighth inning of a baseball game, or late in a football or basketball game, when the fans have had ample time to get themselves pretty well lubricated. But no, I think that would be unrealistic to expect the professional sports leagues or David Stern to make that bold move to eliminate alcohol entirely, partly because it's not just that they sell alcohol in the arenas, but there, you know, the liquor companies pay millions of dollars in corporate sponsorships to these leagues, and they would not, the leagues would not want to offend their sponsors in that way.
And yet, Jeff O'Brien, who can't sympathize with what Sue's saying there? You don't even want to take your family anymore sometimes, because it can be so kind of over the line and just booze-soaked. I was struck by what Phil Taylor said before the break about fans arriving angry at games today. You know, here's the intersection of whatever's going on in society and what gets acted out in these arenas, where the constraints are off, where people feel freer because they're in a competitive zone, I guess. But why arriving angry?
Yeah, there's two pieces to this, the way I see it. One, that most of our sporting venues are not family friendly, first of all. And two, it's almost as these dominant sports have become a gendered experience, and gendered male experience, where men come, and I believe you used the term earlier, gladiators, come to see the gladiators battle and do battle out on the field. And they want to see as much fighting, as much gore as they can. And they're not going to be happy until they see that. And I think that speaks to some of the things that we see portrayed in sport. It was a gentleman, Mike Mesner, wrote a book that dealt with what he called the center of sports, or he used the analogy of ESPN with Sports Center. And what do we really see on Sports Center? How many women's sports do we see on Sports Center? How many craft or artful pieces of the games do we see on Sports Center? We see the hardest hits, we see the biggest dunks, we see people jumping in people's faces.
And we've seen that for a long time, but I wonder if, I mean, you raise the media element here. I wonder if a media that's everywhere all the time is just getting more and more sophisticated about pressing that button, about honing everything down to that aggression button in what you're describing as kind of a male aggression issue.
There's, in my estimation, there's a lot to that. It's, well, what men are, what boys are learning about what it means to be a man and how that manifests itself, or where you can exhibit that type of behavior. Where are the places that you can do that? And we've talked about how this is an outlet where you can, it's a public place where you can stand up and scream and you can announce, you know, who you are, in this case, as a man.
But Jay Coakley says, be careful. Don't think too quickly that this is a kind of negative evolutionary path we're on here. He says, it's always been rough out there. Yet we have a distinct feeling between, you know, Monica Seles being stabbed and chairs flying and all the stuff that's going on. We have a feeling that it's becoming more out of control.
I don't know if that I sense that it's more out of control or not. I think I would more or less agree with Jay that this has been around for a long time. And back to your point about some media sophistication, we see a whole lot more now than we ever saw before. There's not much that these athletes do that we don't know about as soon as it occurs these days.
So if there's a melee, it's on air. In fact, it's kind of celebrated on air in a perverse way.
How many times do you think we've seen as a public the events that occurred at the, in the game last weekend?
A couple. Bill's calling from Northboro, North Carolina. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Actually, it's Bill from Northboro, Massachusetts.
I wondered about
okay.
that. Yeah, it's good. Good to have
I
you, Bill.
I wish
I Thank
were
you.
In North Carolina at
yeah.
the moment. I can't believe some of the excuses I'm hearing for the behavior, not just simply of the players, but of the fans as well.
Let's hear it.
Look, it doesn't take a moral genius or a priest or a cleric or whatever to tell you that it's not necessary to throw a chair at an opposing player. I don't care how worked up you are, or a drink or whatever. There is such a thing called manners. This is disgusting behavior all the way down the line. If you're going to start penalizing the players, by all means do so.
Yeah.
But I also think that the videotape should be run, and that the viewers, the people in the stands who were involved in it, I think they should be prosecuted as well.
Find those fans and bring charges. But what do you think is going on there, Bill? What do you think is running through their heads? Why are they taking those liberties? I mean, you saw running out on the court, just throwing punches just like as gladiators.
Well, first of all, I didn't see it. And I got to be honest with you, I don't watch professional sports as a rule. I watch, for example, the Olympic sports. It's possible to watch a hockey game, for example, where there's not a single fist fight on the ice. Why is that? Because, among other things, in the Olympic, you throw a punch, you're out of the games
yep.
for life.
Yep.
That's it. And I think the American public has no one to blame for that but themselves. They want that sort of thing. They want thuggery on the basketball court. They want thuggery on the hockey ice. I want to see skill when I see a sport played. I don't want to see somebody fighting dirty, being underhanded. I don't consider that to be sportsmanship. And I think the American public, as a rule, is to blame for what passes for sportsmanship today.
And you don't think much of it, Bill. We've got it loud and clear. Thanks very much for that call. Forget the thuggery, but it's hard to forget it when it's right there. Let's get another call. Bob is calling from North Attleboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. How are we doing tonight?
Good. Thanks, Bob.
Great. I sympathize with the caller earlier who was talking about the how impractical it is these days to take children to sporting events. And I grew up going to ball games with parents, uncles. You know?
Yeah.
And these days you can't do that. The swearing, the language in the stands, the activities, the drinking, the inappropriate behavior. It's just something that you can't. You don't want to see modeled for your children.
It's pretty lousy sometimes. Why do you think it's going on, Bob?
I think that people feel perhaps that they're able to exercise some level of control in this situation, that they're ineffectual in other areas that they should be focusing on in their lives, that they're substituting the importance of sports for other things that should be, you know, elevated to that level, but they can't control those situations. So
pouring their emotions out there where they can go through the kind of theater of engagement with it, and you're saying maybe it should be poured somewhere else. Bob, thanks very much for your call. Jay Coakley, how about it? Sports is an arena for pouring out frustration, maybe for things that ought to be better dealt with elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's an arena where there's this kind of a emotional catharsis.
You're not? When was the last time you went to a game? People screaming their brains out, pouring their emotions all over the place?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that doesn't happen at the games. I'm saying to link this to other things that directly outside the stadium to the rest of their lives is something that we really don't know for sure if that's the case. You know, I don't know if more people are entering the stadium with anger today than 5 years ago, and if we're looking down a road where that's going to occur more and more.
We're looking at what happened Friday, and it sure doesn't look good. Let's get another call. Wendy is calling from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, my comment has to do with this not just being a pro sports issue. I see this with my children's soccer and baseball, where parents come and are screaming obscenities in front of the children, threatening the officials. And so I don't think this is just, you know, at professional level. I think this is a society-wide issue for some people.
And what do you think it's about, Wendy? Why do you think that's happening? Why do people feel free to take that liberty at the sideline?
You know, I don't know if it's somewhat anonymity, because there's a crowd there and they feel as though they can get away with, you know, bringing out their aggression.
But they're not so anonymous at your son's soccer or baseball game. You must know half of them.
Well, oftentimes you do, but I don't think if they were the sole person there, they would likely be that disruptive. You know, I see anger and hostility in a lot of places these days, just driving down the road or sometimes in the supermarket line. People are just, in my opinion, more angry and impatient than they used to be. And I don't honestly know the cause. I wish I knew the cause and had a simple solution.
Yeah, Wendy, we've got it, and thanks so much for your call from Sioux Falls. Phil Taylor, that comes back to this kind of ambient anger and the way sports is a kind of magnet for it, a place where they can act out on it, and in a sense have been encouraged by the industry to do that.
Yeah, I think they have. And I mean, all I have is anecdotal evidence. Now, I don't have any research to prove this case, but my sense of people these days is that, in general, is that that they are more impatient. They are maybe angry. Maybe is too strong a word, but they're certainly not willing to. You know, they're not as calm as they once were, and certainly once they get into the arena and the loud music starts and the huge Jumbotron video screen starts imploring them to get louder and to you know, become more and more vocal, I think it's not surprising that some people go over the line. And to make a point about the youth sports that the caller just talked about.
Yes.
I think what happens is that part of the reason I think that some parents, you know, misbehave and abuse the refs and say things they shouldn't is that youth sports today have just become, we've started to make them little major leagues. You know, we've turned everything, kids aren't playing as often just out in the sand lots or out on the playgrounds. They're playing in organized leagues with uniforms and referees, and I think that a lot of adults look at that and start to behave as though they're in Madison Square Garden.
And that doesn't mean good things these days. Phil Taylor, how would you try and redraw that line between players and fans at professional sports games, at basketball in particular, where it's so difficult?
I think I would encourage more contact between players and fans other than just during the games. I would encourage, and some teams do encourage this, they send players out into the community, visiting schools, signing autographs. For instance, one thing that's been suggested is that there should be an autograph session before games that's mandatory for players to participate in, just so that the fans and players can interact with each other one-on-one, and that both sides can see that there are real people on the other side of the coin. I think that what was the point about objectification earlier was right on, because I think that that athletes and fans really don't see each other as people so much anymore as so much as they do. Athletes see the fans as customers, and fans see the athletes as paid performers. And that, I think, is a huge part of the problem.
And the gulf gets wide, and when we saw it breached on Friday night, it wasn't a pretty interaction. Some incredible scene. Phil Taylor, senior writer at Sports Illustrated, thanks a lot for being with us from San Francisco tonight.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Jay Coakley at the University of Colorado, wonderful having you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jay Coakley, professor of sociology at the University of Colorado. And right here with me in Boston, Jeff O'Brien, director of the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program at Northeastern University's Center for the Study of Sport in Society. Great having you, Jeff. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.